Hi, this is Drew, and thanks for listening to our podcast. Hopefully you've been enjoying our show for a while now, but if you're a brand new listener, then the next 50 seconds are not for you, so just go ahead and fast forward a bit. I just wanted to ask our longtime listeners to consider becoming patrons of The Drew Marshall Show, because by throwing us just a few bucks each month, you'll be helping what many tell us is the most brutally authentic spiritual show they've ever heard stay on the air. Look, as loyal podcast listeners, you've been getting the same programming our radio listeners have been hearing live Saturdays 1 to 5 for the last 16 years. Except you get to hear everything commercial-free, you smart consumer, you. Well, because of a brand new arrangement with our studio, our expenses have now gone through the roof. And to be brutally honest, we could use the help to cover those costs. So just before you go to bed tonight, maybe you could stop by our website and click on the giant click here to become a patron sign. And if a whole bunch of you were able to scrounge up like $4 per month, then individually your $4 would have just made a massive difference in helping us cover what it costs to bring you the Drew Marshall Show. Okay, that's it. Sorry to bug you. Now on with the show. I hope you have a good sleep tonight after you become a patron. Some of you may be wondering why we'd be playing the theme from Laverne and Shirley just before an interview.
One of them skinhead?
About just before an interview with a former skinhead and a guy who is sick. And there's two reasons for playing the Laverne and Shirley theme song. First reason is we just lost Laverne.
We did.
Penny Marshall just died this week. And for those of us who grew up with Laverne and Shirley and Mork and Mindy and a whole bunch of
League
movies.
League of Their Own.
Who?
League of Their Own.
Sure.
There's no crying in baseball.
That's right. So just a tribute to her. But also, these guys that we're about to interview are from Milwaukee. No, they're not from Milwaukee. They're from Wisconsin. But Milwaukee is in Wisconsin. And eventually we're going to talk about Kevin Bacon, apparently. 6 degrees of separation here. This is ridiculous. Well, we want to invite the guys on the show right away because we want to make sure that our system is working properly. So, Pardeep, how the heck are things in your world? And where are you, by the way? Are you guys in Oak Creek right now?
Yeah, we're things are great. We are about 5 minutes away from Oak Creek. Milwaukee, Wisconsin is probably about 10 minutes away. So everything is really in proximity, but yeah. We're doing great. Me and Arno are here, and we're happy to join you today.
What did Milwaukee and Wisconsin do when Penny Marshall died? Did they have a big day of mourning for the whole Laverne and Shirley thing? Did that happen?
There was sort of a collective mourning, yeah. But, you know, Penny Marshall meant a lot to Milwaukee, and really just the Laverne and Shirley show at the time really spoke about some of the issues that Milwaukee was facing at that time and even going forward. And very reminiscent of happy days and Laverne and Shirley and those types of shows really putting Milwaukee on the map.
Yeah. But hold on. Now, please forgive me if I got this totally wrong, but you're a child of immigrants. Did you grow up in the United States of America right from the get-go, or how long have you been here? I don't even know. I should know this. Sorry.
Well, yeah. So we moved to Milwaukee when I was 6 years old, and that was in 1982. So at that time, you know, very Laverne and Shirley-ish.
Yeah.
But I'm not born here, but pretty much raised as a Milwaukeean. So that's kind of where I sit. But I my upbringing was kind of different from other people.
You think?
Yeah. So you had a Punjabi kid who was growing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and there's probably 5 Punjabi families when we moved here. And now there's probably about 1,000 within the metro Milwaukee area. So it's grown, but still a very small demographic.
Well, before we turn the conversation over to Arno, I want to get something right out of the way. this is a huge story. But I don't want this to get lost in the story. Your dad is gone, and I'm so sorry about that. I've lost a mom many years ago, and to lose a parent sucks. But to lose a parent to this kind of stuff, oh, man. And it wasn't really that long ago, so it's still got to be really fresh. So I just needed to get that out of the way. I'm sorry that your dad is gone.
No, appreciate that. And it wasn't too long ago, but and it's still, you know, me and Arnold do our best to continue on in his spirit and the spirit of the five others who were killed by Wade Michael Page,
yeah,
who was an affiliated white supremacist that day.
Okay, well, here's...
And, you know, a lot of it's like, it's chronicled in our book, The Gift of Our Wounds. And, you know, we push forward with that, and we thank you for having us on.
Here's the setup that we've been telling everyone about. On August 2012, a white supremacist fatally shot six people in a mass shooting at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. It was the worst race-based attack, apparently, in the U.S. since the KKK bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in 1963. And Pardeep is the son of one of the victims. The man who killed Pardeep's dad was part of one of the largest racist skinhead organizations going. And this organization was founded, or helped founded, partially founded. I don't even know what the right words are. You were part of the founding of this organization, Arno. And so in this story, for all intents and purposes, you're the rat bag.
Yeah, I'd say rat bag zero, actually. I don't want to make it sound like, I founded the group by myself. But I was very involved at the beginning of it and helped to organize it, get it off the ground, get it to the point where it went viral before viral was a thing, and eventually reached all around the world. And today, when there's any kind of violence from far-right white supremacist groups, I take it personally because I had a hand in setting the stage for it. So it's really important to me to respond and to help people heal and to help bring people together in society.
At what point did you find out that this kid was one of yours?
I believe it was the day after the shooting. It was revealed that he was an affiliated white supremacist late on the evening of the day of the shooting itself, but they didn't reveal his name. So I lay awake wondering if this was somebody I had recruited or somebody that I knew. And the next day when they announced his name, Wade Michael Page, I could kind of rule out that I knew him personally. But I believe that's when they revealed his affiliation with Hammerskin Nation, which is the aforementioned group that I was involved with.
Yeah, yeah. Arno, how did you begin, like, explain to us, the rest of us who don't get the whole world of hatred that you dug yourself into, how did you begin to isolate yourself as a kid and why? Because as I understand it, that seems to be sort of the trajectory of most of these guys' stories. It's mostly guys, I'm assuming. Actually, there's a question right off the bat. Mostly guys, I'm assuming?
Yeah, it's pretty much it's been a sausage party all along back to my day and today. I actually know guys who left the movement because they had a hard time picking up girls. Like, going up, like, hey, so how about some white power? Like, it's just not a good way to get laid.
No, no, that's not a good opening line, no.
If you look at anybody who's involved in hate groups, they're, to a person, they're essentially suffering. They're broken, damaged people who have had things go seriously wrong in their life. And while sometimes their lives go wrong because of their own self-induced paranoia that kind of compounds the trauma they're going through, yeah. Trauma is the common factor regardless. And so it's really important to understand that these are people who are hurting and they need help. And the worst thing we can do is to reflect the hatred that they're putting out into the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you start to isolate yourself as a kid. Did that have to do with the fact that you grew up in an alcoholic family? Was that the main reason? I mean, I think a lot of kids start to pull away from their family for sure, but you didn't just pull away from your family. You were sort of, I don't know, socially dopey as well.
I was very much an outlier as a kid, especially looking at the backgrounds of people who are typically in hate groups. I grew up in a nice house, nice neighborhood. I had everything going for me, and my parents loved me very much, and they tried to support me. All the adults in my life were behind me, but I think it's a mix of my personality type, which is just I got to be in constant motion and constantly doing crazy things to keep myself amused. And the suffering that I felt because my parents' relationship really sucked. And my mom was miserable throughout my childhood. And rather than being a good kid and being like, hey, Mom, I love you, how can I help? I just started to distance myself from her and from my dad, who did love me very much. You know, the disease that he has has nothing to do with how much he loves me. And, of course, as I isolated myself more, my suffering got worse, and I started hurting other kids and getting stimulation from doing that, and especially from, like, just causing trouble at school, watching teachers and principals tear their hair out at what I was doing. It gave me a sense of power. It gave me a thrill. And, like any kind of substance abuse, it was very much something that had to keep escalating to give me the same thrill. So before you know it, I went from a bully on the school bus in kindergarten to a 16-year-old alcoholic who had been violent since he was a little kid. And that's when I heard White Power Skinhead music, and nothing repulsed people like a swastika. And I was a kid who just lived to repulse people, and that's really was the initial attraction for me.
So booze and beatings, but hate was your worst habit. True story?
Yeah, hate was just part of the adrenaline rush. Okay. It was just part of the addiction, and I even though I knew it was wrong, it, in the same way that like a heroin junkie knows that it's wrong to steal things or to prostitute themselves to support their addiction, they do it anyway because all they care about is getting high, and all I cared about was getting that adrenaline rush. And that all those things were definitely in play as I got involved in it when I was 16.
Okay, so was it real hate or teenage hate or angst hate or social anxiety hate or fitting in hate? I mean, you know, I don't even know how to delineate all that stuff, but I guess poser hate is probably the best way to say it.
Yeah, I a lot of people who knew me back then would have challenged me and said, you know, you were a nice kid and you really weren't that bad, and you know, just it's interesting how people have different perspectives on things. But to me, if you want to define hate as a willful lack of, a willful denial of compassion for someone suffering, that was the hate that I traded in, and there definitely was a poser element to it. You know, when you say that hate's your thing and you start running with it, and all of a sudden you're kind of obligated to be the most hateful of all. And I was definitely putting on a show throughout those 7 years involvement in hate groups. I don't think that's really who I was as a person, but I would say that for any violent extremist of any stripe. I don't think any human being really enjoys hating and hurting people. It all comes from suffering.
Okay, Pardeep, different story. Immigrant family, wanted to do the right thing, give back. You become a cop. Your dad was, from as far as I understand, it was you know, one of the top dogs at the Sikh temple. Sikh temple, as I've been educated how to say it a million times by Tim. Sorry, Tim, I screwed up. I tried hard to be cool.
I still love you. I don't hate you.
Thank you. So, and your dad was like 1 month into collecting Social Security, and then, man, everything just goes south. So let's get people into the story. Sorry, guys, I know you've told it a million times, but this helps the rest of us. I think this really helps the rest of us. Once we start to get the context of this, then we can understand the depth of forgiveness. Because I think when you generically forgive, then the freedom that comes with it is also generic. So I think specifics are a very big part of this. So you and your family, Pardeep, were on your way to temple, and then, like most daughters, you're on your way, and, oh, Dad, I forgot something, and you got to go back to the stinking house, and that made you 10 minutes later than you would have been. True story? Did I get all that right?
Yep. Oh, yeah, you got that all right.
So then you rock up to the temple, and things are going down, or what happened? Like, take us through what happened next.
Yeah, no, then we pull over to the side of the road where, you know, the temple is, and it's barricaded off. You know, I'm a former police officer, so I kind of like, there's something going off in my intuition, and it's telling me that something is not right down the street, but I don't know exactly what is happening. And I get out and I ask the police officer, you know, sir, what's going on? What happened? Why can we not proceed down the street? And he tells me there's been a shooting at the temple, and the scene is not secure. And, you know, from there, just a mixture of emotions from, you know, from a relief, honestly, to be to say, okay, well, she forgot that notebook at the house, and it kept us safe, to feeling guilt, to feeling anger, to feeling like, and I'm one of those types of people that I feel like I can do something about anything. So total helplessness was the feeling that entire day. And I think we as a community kind of felt that, because, you know, we'll go back to the Laverne and Shirley show and really talk about, and in the 80s, 70s, and late 70s, early 80s, when we came here, Milwaukee was a really thriving city. And, you know, people could get going jobs. And then over time, the city deteriorated. And for various reasons, my dad was always a pillar within that city. And really just making a home for other immigrants to come, especially sick immigrants. But he, you know, people called him Sam, Uncle Sam. And so he really embodied the whole American dream. And as we started to, you know, proceed forward, I guess is the best way to say it, to say, okay, like, we can't let this, what happened to us, define us, but we have to do something about it. We really thought about it as much more of this is not just about six people, six immigrants being killed. This is about us preserving this American dream for other people when they come over and say, okay, what is it that I can do? If I can lift myself up by my bootstraps, then who are you to try to say that I don't belong here?
At some point, Pardeep, I mean, we're talking about the forgiveness aspect here, and I've got so many questions coming up in my brain, but at some point, like, it kind of sounds like you went from, oh, my dad was killed, to, oh, I forgive, and you start writing Hallmark cards, and it's a beautiful thing, you know. You must have raged a bit in between, did you not?
Oh, yeah, I did. I was angry, and, you know, I think anger is part of the process of forgiveness. I don't think forgiveness is forgetting. To us, forgiveness is very much vengeance against what happened to you, and to basically say, you know what, I'm going to reclaim my life, not just for myself, but for my kids, my family, my community. And because of what you did, our community is going to be much stronger than it ever was before. And in Sikhi, we have something called Kurbani or Shahidi or martyrdom. And it's the most noblest death is a death that is dedicated to something bigger than yourself.
Yeah.
And so knowing that dad helped build that temple, build a congregation, build a community, and died in the place that he helped build, you know, holding a butter knife to a gunman, he might have lost that fight, but he did not lose that war.
I want your reaction to this statement, and then I want to jump back to Arno here in a second. Pardeep, someone comes up to you and says, I don't know, maybe even at your dad's funeral, they might say to you, well, your dad died a good death. Mm-hmm. Well, how does the oldest son feel about that statement? Because if it was me, I'm thinking maybe a right hook to the solar plexus might be a good response.
Yeah, no, I'd say, yeah, I think he did die a good death, and I think he did live a good, I think he lived a great life. And, you know, he was 65 years old, like you said, and he was kind of joking around about the first month of collecting Social Security, and then really being like, wow, this country is great. That, and then he was the hardest working person that I have ever physically ever seen or known of. And I mean, it's almost a legend how hard he used to work. And he was just a small, wiry guy, but he would never, ever give up.
Hold on, Pardeep. Yeah. Like, I guess where I want to go in this part of the conversation is, you know, I think it gets dangerous when you start faking forgiveness, when you know it's the right response, when you know it's the proper way to proceed with things, when you know the trajectory of your story has to involve forgiveness at some point. So you sort of start to fake it. And someone says, well, your dad died a good mm-hmm. death. In a Sikh tradition, that's an honorable thing, you know, blah, blah, blah. But your dad was murdered. And... Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, man. That sucks. And for someone to say your dad died a good death, that doesn't cut it for me, you know? And did you not go through some kind of, I hear this a lot from people where, you know, they try the fake it till you make it thing. You know, mm-hmm. let's fake the that everything's peachy until all of a sudden you realize, whoa, things are not peachy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, I think you kind of, you know, you touched on as far as like being able to fake it till you make it. But really, like, it's for us, it's kind of like forgiveness is not really forgetting. It's not, it's never been about forgetting. Forgiveness is not about getting over or things like that. It's really about, hey, what are you going to do about this? And it's about responsibility. And yeah, no, I think what can you do about a person that's already dead? You can either go on with having a more bitter life, or you can have a better life. And really, that starts with, like, you know, going from like bitter to bitter to being better. You have to change the I first and foremost. And I realized that I didn't take life seriously before his death. I took things for granted. I took life for granted. And seeing death up close and knowing that you could have been there had she not forgot that notebook, really, you start to go through this like whole post-traumatic growth.
Yeah.
Where things are just so much better than they were before, because we all got to go one day. But to die for something that like you really believe in, or to live a life worth believing in, is to die a death that is really something worth dying for.
Arno, I do want to get to you in a second, because I've watched a few of the interviews that you guys have done, and Arno, you and I would be a good hang. We would be dangerous, but it'd be a good hang.
It's on.
All right, we are back with the boys, Dub Boys, Pardeep and Arno. And the quick summation is, Arno used to be a white supremacist. And by the way, is it supremacist or supremacist, Arno?
I find myself saying supremacist, but in print, the word processor says it's supremacist. And who am I to question our Google overlords?
Yes, okay.
Is it GIF or GIF?
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, I used to be a white supremacist, and turns out a white supremacist fatally shot and killed Pardeep's dad. And Pardeep's on the phone with us. Arno's on the phone with us. And the organization that Arno helped start was this group of skinheads that the killer was a part of. So there's a real, genuine processing of forgiveness that needed to happen between these two guys. And I want to get into... Arno, I want to bring you in here real quick, but just before we get to you, Pardeep used to be a popo, and nothing is cooler than a 52-year-old guy saying popo.
You are so OG.
Yeah. So it used to be 5-0, and then and so you've got some suspicious minds like Elvis, and you guys have this meeting where, for whatever reason, you decide to get together, and I don't know how the conversation is going to go. Like, oh, sorry, your dad got killed, and yeah, that sucked, and sorry, you used to be white supremacist, and I don't know. It could be incredibly awkward, like a bad Tinder date or something. And so did you not have any weird red flags when you met Arno? Like how do you know this guy was legit? About no longer being a dude of hate.
I didn't, and I mean, that's a lot of people had warned me and said, you know, once a white supremacist, always a white supremacist, and you know, part of that fear was still there, but that's courage, is to be able to fight that fear and go forward with it. And I really, honestly, like I needed to understand why somebody did something like this. After a shooting happens, there's a lot of tight lip. Law enforcement and things like that, and there's a lot of investigation that needs to be done. But the victims of these crimes need to have some explanation on what, you know, why somebody did something like this. And you know, at that time, I also knew that sometimes we don't choose what happens to us, but we sure choose what we do with it. And if the response wasn't stronger than what happened to you, well, then the shooter won, and the likelihood of this happening again increases.
Yeah,
And that's responsibility, is to know that like you're gonna either put other people in harm's way, or you're gonna keep people from being murdered in their places of worship by the response that you have.
Arno, let me just say that it was a very smooth move for you guys to have this meeting at a Thai food place.
Well, I no longer drink. I quit drinking after drinking profusely for 20 years in 2004, and nowadays. Chili is how I get a buzz. So I get like the hottest battery acid, melt your face, spicy food I can handle. And then I make sure I have a designated driver. And the Thai food restaurant in question is kind of legendary for its spiciness. And it's just kind of a conditioned response to me. If somebody's in town, if you ever come to Milwaukee, Drew, and we go get something to eat, it's just Isan's where we're going to go. So that was just a knee-jerk reaction to Parr asking where we're going to go. And, yeah, he felt at ease when I suggested Thai food. Had I said, that's some sauerkraut and bratwurst and Wiener Schnitzel, like, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
So good. So good. Arno, has your old posse tried to mess with you when you, especially right after you sort of got out?
When I first got out, it's funny because Parr and I do corporate trainings now, and we help businesses develop purpose-driven missions and whatnot, and healthy corporate cultures, organizational cultures. But the organizational culture of my skinhead gang was hate and violence. And the organization itself was accordingly dysfunctional. So while we peaked at about 150 people around 91, 92, by 94 when I left, it had completely self-destructed. We were fighting each other more than anything else. And it was just kind of me and the guys in my band and a couple other older guys. And we were all getting burnt out. We all had young families. We were working menial jobs to keep them going. And when I left, I think the other guys were more jealous of me leaving than they were angry.
Wow. Okay, I don't know who wants to take this question, but I have a hard time with this sentence, and I want one of you to help me with it. I can't believe how quick this time went. We got to get you guys back on the show. Look, let me just say this before I get into this question. If a former skinhead, you know, racist, white supremacist, whatever, blah, 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 and the son of a guy who was killed by a white supremacist, if these guys can get together and start changing lives and hearts and attitudes, then for goodness sake, you know, give your kid a break this Christmas, or lighten up on that crazy uncle you have, or I don't know, whatever it is. That's the point of these conversations we've been having. The Forgiveness Project is a great organization. The website is theforgivenessproject.com. You can read lots of stories there, inspirational stuff. You can certainly get a book called The Gift of Our Wounds, written by these two guys, Pardeep and Arno. But this is, I just want people to think through, is it worth it? Is it really necessary to harbor what you've been harboring? Because if these guys can do what they're doing, good night. Think about what you don't know our story. Well, I'm not sure it can get any crazier than what these guys are talking about. So anyway, let me throw this out at you. Here's the sentence that, again, drives me a little wonky. Wonky? How about crazy?
Wacky?
Bonker? Wacky, I don't know.
Bonkers.
Anyway, time heals all wounds. Makes me want to throw punch someone.
You got a whole list of people you want to punch today, Drew.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
We need help from Milwaukee.
Maybe you could put the fighting back in hockey single-handedly.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it's just one of those pat bumper stickers that I don't think people really think through.
It's like anything else. It's how you interpret it and how you look at it. It's easy to interpret time heals all wounds as like blowing off or marginalizing the suffering that's happening. And in that interpretation, it's extremely problematic. At the same time, I look at that phrase as something inspirational and saying that healing is a natural process, and it does happen in one way or another as time progresses. But if we accelerate that process with compassion, with forgiveness, with kindness, with gratitude, it becomes all the more powerful. So I think it's a good thing that time heals, but we don't want to leave it at that.
Yeah, because, I mean, in my thinking, and Pardeep, maybe you can speak to this, you know, I've worked with horses a whole bunch, not as much as certainly many people in my life, but if they have a wound, an injury, no, you just don't leave it. You gotta scour that thing, and it's stinking hurts the horse. You gotta put in the betadine solution. You gotta dig out the junk that's in there, and eventually, sure, time helps the healing, But if you just leave it, then that thing, the horse walks differently as a result of you ignoring the wound.
Yep. Yep. And that's the crippling effect. And then, yeah, I think you're right. I think time doesn't heal all wounds. Time can actually make some wounds worse. And it's time plus purpose, or the process, that helps to heal those wounds. And we say, pain without purpose is pointless, but purpose derived from pain is the most powerful. And so, yes, we are an organic filter of healing, but you got to actually, there's a process that needs to take place. And, with that horse, there's a process of cleansing that needs to take place. And within our country, I think there's a process that really needs to take place.
Man. Well, look, get the book. It's called The Gift of Our Wounds. You can get it where people get books, that was profound. You can go to theforgivenessproject.com, find out all sorts of stories, including all the ones we've had over the last few weeks. Pardeep and Arno, so much more could have been talked about, but we've just run out of time. But I just want people to find out about you so they can lean in themselves and I don't know, look into your story a little bit more for the sole purpose of a little bit more healing in their lives. So thank you. From a guy who, I don't know, I try not to be a big mushbag, but when I think about what you guys are doing out there, it kind of melts me a little bit. So thank you very, very much to both of you, Pardeep and Arno. Merry Christmas, guys.
Merry Christmas. Thank you, Drew.
Thank you, Drew. And people can also go to giftofourwounds.com to find our book, to find more about Serve to Unite, our organization, and to find more stories of people who have found the gift in their wounds.
Good plug. Good plug. I should have said that. Sorry. I suck.
Somebody's got to do it, Drew.
Find your purpose with pain, Drew.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Merry Christmas. See you, boys. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas.
Bye.